This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Dara here. Yeah, I'm back off the menu. We're kicking it here. We have a jam-packed show today. First off, we got Pulitzer Prize finalist Mara Vistendahl, my new favorite person in the great state of Minnesota. Something of a genius. She's also a mom who lives in St. Louis Park. She has this new thriller of a nonfiction book about espionage in the cornfields. I am doing an event with her Tuesday night at Majors and Quinn, and I'm just crazy about this book. It's a page turner. It's got spies in the corn. Super into that. But it raises a whole bunch of extremely interesting questions, one of which is, when you think about corn, I feel like I think about it as like, it's sweet corn season. It's corn on the cob. I'm going to get the butter out. But corn is way more than food at this point. And Mara Vistendahl, what is corn in the year 2019 or 2020?
Well, corn is the source of much of the fuel that we use, much of the food that we eat, right? We need it in the form of animal feed to go into meat, and something like a land the size of the state of California is covered with corn in the United States. So there's just so much corn in our diet at this point, and in the global diet. That it has become a massive commodity.
And I didn't realize this until I read your book, is that, you know, we're just used to it. You drive down the road, there's a cornfield, but it is actually a site of complex proprietary technology.
That's right. Yeah, so I actually used to be a reporter in China. I was working for the journal Science. And one day I read this story in the New York Times while I was living in Shanghai about a man named Robert Mo who was found in a cornfield in Iowa. And he had, it was a Monsanto cornfield. The company protected the corn that was growing there as trade secrets. And, you know, it was like so secretive that they didn't even tell the farmer who grows the corn what kind of seed he's planting every year, and, you know, it would arrive in these unmarked bags. And so Robert Mo's found in this field, and that sets off this immense FBI investigation spanning 2 years, involving car chases and surveillance planes and warrants that are reserved for national security threats, usually.
It's just such a crazy story. I find it's very much page-turner. I'm going to ask you if there's been any movie interest in this. The book is called The Scientist and the Spy, True Story of China, the FBI, and Industrial Espionage. But one of the things I find most charming is just the idea that, I mean, we all drive down the road through cornfields, and the idea that, you know, if you have important proprietary Silicon Valley information is in a vault or it's locked in a laboratory, but the corn still, even if it's the most important corn, it still needs the sun and the rain and so on and so forth. And we could just be like in the most secret thing in the world and never know.
So companies like Monsanto, which is now owned by Bayer, and DuPont Pioneer, which is another company that came up in the book, they devote a lot of effort to protecting their trade secrets. And the corn that was growing in this field in Iowa was inbred seed that the company was going to use to make the next generation of corn that it would sell to farmers. Now, Robert Mo worked for a company in Beijing. He was a Chinese scientist who had moved to the United States in the 1990s to make his career here. His dreams didn't materialize when he failed to get tenure. as a scientist. And so he used nepotism to get a job at this Beijing seed company. They wanted to make genetically modified corn seed. And instead of investing a lot of money in the research and, you know, years of work that it would take to get that, they saw this shortcut in just like literally digging it up from the field in Iowa and Illinois. And it at one point, even trying to smuggle it back to China in microwave popcorn bags.
Ah, I love that. It is so crazy. I mean, it's so smart too. It's like it would be, that's a good place to hide corn.
Yeah, it's smart unless the FBI is on your tail and like watching every move.
I love it. Yeah, the whole thing. I don't know how much to tell people about it because I feel like they should just read it. I don't want to give things away. It's called The Scientist and the Spy. It's by Mara Fistendahl. So I want people to know who you are because I feel like you became this Pulitzer Prize finalist, very important nonfiction writer, kind of when you were based out of the cities. But then you came back here to raise your kids, who are lovely little perfect people, of course. Maybe don't know. So yes. Let's give people an overview. You are a hometown hero. You're a hometown girl.
Yes. I'm from Northfield originally. My grandparents lived in Iowa, so, you know, spent a lot of time in Iowa as a kid. And, you know, Northfield's surrounded by cornfields, so, you know, had my share of, like, corn mazes and corn palaces and so forth.
I love a corn maze.
I went to later moved to the cities with my mom. I went to Hopkins High School.
A lot of moms in Hopkins don't speak Chinese, but your mom did, right? Because your grandpa was a missionary?
My grandfather had been a Lutheran missionary to Taiwan and Singapore. My mom does speak some Chinese. She studied it at Carleton. And when we moved to the cities, she moved in with a Chinese friend who had a son around the ages of me and my brother. And they kind of co-parented us and raised us together. So I heard it growing up, which was helpful. I didn't learn to speak it until I was in high school. That's when I first started studying it.
And then you kept going with it, right?
Yeah, well, Chinese is a lifelong pursuit. I feel like I'm still studying it. My kids are in Chinese immersion school now, and I'm now like relearning the language through them.
Oh, and so then you went to, you know, you went to college, you went to grad school, you did all the things, and you actually went and moved to China, and you were an on-the-ground China reporter. A lot of people probably know, your first more famous book. It was about, you know, kind of gender selection, brutal gender selection in Asia, unnatural selection, choosing boys over girls, and the consequences of a world full of men. And so that's where you were based when you were writing that.
That's right. Yeah. I moved to China basically after I finished journalism school to freelance. I had an editor who said, oh, if you speak Chinese, just go and, you know, see what you can do there. And after a few years there, got this idea to write a book, and I was lucky enough to be given the chance to do it with a series publisher. And that was a different book. It was a kind of idea book where I went to, I think, 7 or 8 countries, interviewed like women who'd had abortions because the baby was a girl, talked to doctors, I talked to sex workers, I talked to, you know, men who couldn't find wives because of this shortage of females. And I tried to, you know, turn that all into still a really compelling narrative that asked a lot of questions. And
It's a terrific book because I think as a Westerner who's paying attention, my general take in it has always been, that's not fair. You know, it's not fair to do that to girls. But you kind of took it all through it to the logical endpoint of a universe where a bunch of people can't get married, can't continue. I didn't realize, you know, you always see these just gruesome headlines about rape in India. I don't know how else to say that. And then, you know, I didn't kind of connect the dots between gender selection and that until your book.
Many people would say there is a definite connection, because you have now this shortage of women as a result of sex selection in Asia. And, you know, the result is that people are buying brides, they're trafficking in women, they're, you know, buying sex work and so forth. But I did actually go back to the United States and go to these kind of high-tech clinics where unscrupulous doctors are offering Americans the chance to choose the sex of their baby.
Oh, yeah. I often wondered what is going on behind closed doors. I mean, I'm sure there's all kinds of...
Yeah, and this is not for, you know, there are a lot of medical reasons that people would do that, like if they have a sex-linked disease and so forth. But, you know, this is people who just really want a boy or really want a girl. But, you know, these doctors are sort of oblivious to the global consequences of what they're doing.
So you have established a career as someone who is very insightful about China being really just a maelstrom of emotion in America at this point. You know, people are worried about unfair competition, worried about industrial espionage. The week that your book comes out, everybody is worried about the coronavirus. And so you have a great sympathy for Chinese people and Chinese culture. And I think that has given you a kind of a more nuanced and unique perspective. I mean, I think people would be surprised to know that The Scientist and the Spy, your new book, thriller and page turner as it is, it's not like Chinese people bad.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, as the coronavirus is a really good example of how there is still a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment in the United States. You know, I'm having reported on the Chinese government and like had to parse Chinese government announcements for years. I'm no fan of the government. You know, I think what's happening in northwestern China, where over a million people are detained in camps. These are primarily members of a Muslim Uyghur minority. I think that's absolutely horrible. But in my book, I wanted to look at how this focus on China and our rising tensions between the two countries is affecting average people, both in China and in America. So, you know, there are a lot of I kind of crisscrossed the Midwest, retracing the steps of Robert Moe and talking to American farmers as well, and looking at how they are impacted by these tensions between the two countries.
It's just fascinating. All right, so I just think this is terrific. I know there's an excerpt of this coming out in Vanity Fair. Is that out?
It's out.
It's
yeah.
out. Oh,
yeah.
Everybody, you can go to vanityfair.com and check out the excerpt of the book. It's just really terrific. I can't recommend it enough. I wrote about Mara for Minneapolis St. Paul magazine. That piece is out and about in the world. A Northfield girl with gumption. You have some readings coming up. You've got this one Tuesday night at Majors & Quinn in Uptown Minneapolis. I will be there. I'll be just celebrating you because I love this book so much. And then
you
will be reading in Northfield.
I'm going to read in Northfield on February 29th. It's a Saturday at 3 p.m. At Content Books. And I'm hoping to do a few others in the Twin Cities as well.
Okay. Well, yeah. If anybody is kind of thinking, I would like to get Mara Vistendahl out to Hopkins or something, you can find her full on maravistendahl.com. You can find a link from my Facebook page, Dara.Gromdahl. Oh, I just realized we got two dolls on the radio here. This is it.
I know.
Oh, very funny.
All right. So Minnesotan.
It's very Minnesotan. All the transplanted Norwegian. All right. So congratulations on this book. And can I've got to ask if there's been movie interest. It is such a fascinating, just gripping tale.
So my agent's shopping it around in Hollywood now. There is I should say that there is one character in the book. The book is told from these multiple perspectives, from the perspective of Robert Moe, for one, the guy who was found in the field, from the perspective of the FBI agent who tailed him for 2 years. His name is Mark Benton, and he's a good old Nebraska boy. And then there's this third character who is this farmer from Illinois who had been kind of a useful stooge in this Chinese operation. He was hired to be a consultant for the Beijing company and, with little awareness of what they had planned. And then several months into his work for them, the FBI knocks on his doorstep and he becomes this very reluctant informant for the FBI. So this guy, Kevin, is a third character in the book.
That'll be William Macy. I'm sure that's who that'll be.
Kevin really wants Tom Hanks to play.
Oh, Tom Hanks. Yeah. Of course, we all want Tom Hanks to play us. That's the, except me, I'm too short. But yeah. I can't recommend this enough. It's called The Scientist and the Spy. You can come get a signed copy Tuesday night at Majors and Quinn. But also, I just recommend it because you got to drive sometimes from Mankato to New Prague, and this just adds a whole new layer. You're like, oh, I'm in the Fort Knox. I didn't know that I'm just in the vault here.
It's true. Yeah, Midwestern intrigue.
That's perfect. All right. Well, congratulations. Thank you for coming in this morning. I know you got a busy morning juggling kids, just as we all do in the Midwest here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, I had a bunch of, I got a text from somebody who was saying that Monsanto's former Olivia, Minnesota research station was one of the world's best at developing new corn hybrids with hundreds of patents. Yeah, I bet there's a bunch of corn scientists who are listening to us right now who are like, oh, the stories I could tell, but I'm legally prevented from telling them.
I did talk to a number of the seed scientists in the process of doing the book. And in fact, Kevin, in addition to being a farmer, is a seed breeder. So he helped a lot with the research side, as well as just like relating his story and his play-by-play of his very comical tale of the day when the FBI showed up on his doorstep.
Yeah, you're just a corn farmer. All of a sudden you got the FBI to tangle with. It's a story. All right, The Scientist and the Spy, Mara Vestindahl. We're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back. We've got, we've got a whole bunch of situations. I've got Klecko. Now all of a sudden, St. Paul's most famous bread baker is turning into one of Minnesota's most successful poets, and he's in the house, and we will talk to him when we come back. Dara here. All right, we got a fun rockin' show today. It's just so broad. We're covering all that. I can't remember when Klecko and I first met. Klecko is a legend of St. Paul baking. He ran St. Agnes for years. St. Agnes got kind of shut down in a dramatic situation about which no one's allowed to talk about with ICE until today, I guess. And he wrote this book called Hitman, Baker, Casket Maker. It's poetry. Klecko, you big old poet, you. And now I hear it's a bestseller, and Klecko is here to talk about. He's going to be at the Charlie Awards tomorrow and all the things. Klecko, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, and I bring you glad tidings from the capital city. And, yes, tomorrow, just across the street from here, pretty close, I'll be at the Pantages Theater for the Charlie Awards. If you're not familiar with that, it's the culinary equivalent to the Oscars, and Klecko will be on board as entertainment, doing two different sets, much like Saturday Night Live.
Are you playing music?
No, I'm reading from my book, but I'm a performance artist at heart, and I think a lot of the thrilling component to this will be what will Klecko wear. I mean, I can't confer or deny that Vegas might have a betting line at set one and set two, but no, at the Charlie Awards is
you
for all the people.
Sequins? You got feathers? What are we looking at here?
No, I'm not at liberty to discuss that, but the Charlie Awards is great because for anyone who's ever worked hospitality, It's wonderful to see people in this very difficult industry get honored and have appreciation showed towards them. You know, I really highly, highly recommend coming down and seeing it. It's a quick show. There's a little after party at Seven Steakhouse. So
fun.
Yeah, but you know, primarily, you know, the beautiful people. The beautiful people come on
such
out.
Such as yourself.
Well,
all
of
right,
course,
so
right?
The bakers and stuff. All right, so tell me about, were you a poet this whole time?
Yes. I've been doing poetry for quite a few years, and, you know, it's part of running a oven, closing ovens for times. But, you know, I've been writing business columns, things like this, books, cookbooks, all kinds of things. But poetry, to me, is probably my favorite way to, you know, express the things that are going on. I think you can have more impact with less words than you can with more.
So if I had been in the St. Agnes Bakery and I would see you at, you know, closing time, which is, you know, 9 a.m, would you have been kind of scribbling in a little
constantly, really? Constantly. Yeah. I mean, I have shoe boxes filled with different thoughts, ideas, because, you know, as they say, a poem is never completely finished. But yeah, I've enjoyed it. I've been very fortunate to be under the mentorship of some of the best poets. I helped Carol Connolly, the Poet Laureate of St. Paul, work on her reading series at the University Club, where I got to introduce everyone from, you know, Robert Bly to state laureates to, you know, all the way down the line. So it's been a wonderful opportunity for me.
I love a baker poet. All right, we're going to take a little break here and have some weather and ads and stuff. We're going to come back with Klecko, the most famous poet baker of the state. I'm going to say, I can't think of another one. So more Klecko when we come back. All right, Dara here. I am back with Klecko, the legendary baker of St. Paul. He's going to be leading some special entertainment tomorrow at the Industry Charlie Awards. And he has this new book, Hitman Baker, Casket Maker. And he is going to read us a poem. This will be the first in the history of the, I believe, 8 years now of Off the Menu, our first poem. Klecko, take it away.
And once again, thanks. If you're looking for Hitman Baker Casket Maker, Paris Morning Publications, or go to Amazon. The poem I'm going to read is called Lunch with Oso. It's kind of like if this was a record, this would be the hit single, counting down 3, 2, 1. Every day, for 21 years, I ate lunch with Oso, the morning bread mixer, in the employee break room, where we combined our food onto a single plate. On the final day of production, after setting out our meal, neither one of us ate. We weren't hungry. Neither one of us could sleep. We were past tired. It had been a 90-hour work week. So we just sat together quietly. I didn't know what to say, so I asked, "You gonna be okay?" He nodded yes before explaining, "The biggest mistake I made was I got too comfortable. As a Mexican, I should have known better. Thank you."
Oh, devastating. So is this the time that this story can be told? So St. Agnes Bakery was a heritage, famous, much beloved bakery on West 7th Street in St. Paul. And ICE basically came in and shut you down.
Well, yeah, it was a tacit shutdown, to be sure. I mean, basically we had the contracts for the Super Bowl and
And this was right before the Super Bowl.
This was right before. And so they gave us a 10-day period to shut down. In the past, you can negotiate with ICE, but under the current administration, not so much. And so it was a very difficult time because as CEO, I wasn't in a position where I could really discuss this, because if I had to tell my accounts that service was going to be suspended, look for new purveyors. But if I would have said that I was shutting the doors for good, then ICE can move to the front of the line. And everyone knows who works hospitality, pay the employees first, the purveyors second. So, you know, you want to make sure you get the money into the hands of those people before fines are levied, and they were, and they weren't small.
Really? Okay. So you're able to talk about the last days of St. Agnes and how ICE shut everything down. I know that, you know, I talked to you at the time, and you were just trying to pay everybody. That was it. You said, you know, we
right.
can't talk.
Right. And so the book Hitman Baker Casket Maker, you know, deals not only with the shutdown, but, you know, a lot of the lesson that I learned and I'm continuing to learn is I advocate for my crew of 23 that had dirty I-9s is so much of St. Paul turned its back. They turned their back on these people that we have begged for decades, people who we built traditions for, baked nights and weekends for. People turned their backs on them, and nobody asked or cared. And you know, we're trying to deal with certain agencies, but these people were left hanging after, you know, St. Paul is a sanctuary city. So if you're going to be a sanctuary city, you know, you have to offer some kind of security. But I would, you know, really quick, like to not get political, but say I'm a big fan of Melvin Carter. I think for the first time in a long time, we have a mayor that's in the capital city that actually is trying to do work. Oftentimes, you know, I mean, people are always going to dig at you for something. But Mayor Melvin Carter goes to every corner of our city and is working in hospitality. I can tell you he's in Midway, he's in East Side, he's on West Side. So he's the first mayor that doesn't just hang out downtown. So I do have hope, and that's why I'm going to continue speaking and talking about this topic. You know, I'm even taking it back to D.C. in April for National Poetry Month and just continue representing my crew.
All right. Well, if people want to find out more about what really happened, it's conveyed through poetry. Hitman Baker, Casket Maker. I was surprised. We were talking in the green room, and you were saying that you feel like a lot of people in St. Paul are kind of living high on the hog on the labor of people from Mexico and Central America, and it's time to start grappling with that.
Well, I do, and I do, and I've made some enemies. Yeah, I like to point out primarily white people of St. Paul. You know, because I know a lot of African-Americans, Hmongs, different people like that. Even the queer community understands what it is to be minority, to be singled out. But, you know, there's so many people in my demographic that they just really don't know when that person who is making the bed in their hotel or that person who's handing them a Big Mac is living in abject fear that these people are going home every night, because we are living in a city where there's a system set up that says we'll let you stay here, but you know they can never get past a certain point, and they're always under the threat of fear, and it's really discouraging, and so you know so many people think they're doing something nice by hitting like on Facebook, but you know that does very little. You have to get out there and you have to speak. You have to get out there and you have to talk to your neighbors. You know, I mean, there's only so much that we can do, but these people are indentured servants at best. So, I mean, I'm really, really hopeful that people will, you know, once again, remember the city of St. Paul is inviting people here through tacit agreements to come on up because we are a sanctuary city and they're going to keep coming. So I just hope that you'll be nice.
All right. Being nice is hard. It's always like easy to tell other people to be nice. It's hard to do the work, as it were. So if you want to see Klecko, he is at the Charlie Awards tomorrow. And Klecko, if people want to get your book, how do they get that?
Well, once again, best way, support my publisher, Julie Fitzinger, at Paris Morning Publications. Go to their website. But if not, you can go to The Beast, go to Amazon. They'll sell you a book. Or you can go to independent bookstores. My favorite bookstore in the state of Minnesota would be Subtext Books St. Paul.
Oh, Subtext in St. Paul. That's a great one. Yeah, go there. Get a real copy. See some real people. Klecko, thank you so much for coming in today. I'm going to follow up with you and see if I can get some more details about all the things you're up to. We're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back with Ronnie Cummins. He has a new book, Grassroots Rising. It's about how we can prevent climate collapse, which is a thing that needs to get done, because he's going to be at a local bookstore, too. It's local bookstore day here and off the menu. All right, Klecko, thanks for coming in. Tara here. All right, so Grassroots Rising is a call to action on climate, farming, food, and a Green New Deal. Ronnie Cummins has devoted his life to trying to get us on the right path. We don't ever seem to get there. But Ronnie Cummins, thank you for coming on the show today. First, let's get a little bit, who are you? What you been up to?
Well, I've been an activist since the 1960s, and I moved to Minnesota in the early 80s. And I helped found an organization called Organic Consumers Association, which is a large network of organic consumers, 2 million organic consumers across the U.S. And I've written books on genetically engineered food and other topics. And my latest book is on the climate crisis and how our food and farming and the way we use land practices are a major part of solving this crisis and a whole lot of other problems that we have in society as well.
So you have been part of this, the whole, you know, I think a lot of people think of that organics were always there, but organics only started in the late 90s. And so you've just been there since the day one.
Yes, from our office in northern Minnesota and our staff in the Twin Cities, we helped lead a campaign in 1998 that stopped the government from degrading organic standards because they were saying that genetically engineered food and sewage sludge and nuclear radiation would be okay. And we've grown and expanded our efforts from that time, not only across the U.S., but into Mexico and internationally.
All right. So I do remember that nuclear waste situation. They wanted to irradiate food, and it was so crazy. The idea was that you could kill pathogens through nuclear waste, and then but it was just like if you only have one little cell that's bad left, it could just grow back to the original population. It was just the bonkers thing. And so thank you for protecting us from that. You know, I think a lot of us are feeling quite hopeless at this point about climate change, because, you know, anytime you go to do something, a whole bunch of misinformation rushes into the space to say, like, no, the only thing we can do is eat, we could just eat toxic patties and that's the solution to everything. So walk me through, what are some things that can be done?
Well, most people understand that converting to renewable energy, solar and wind, and implementing radical energy conservation, reducing the amount of fossil fuels that we use, are a solution to the climate crisis. The reason, though, that most people are pessimistic that we can do what world scientists tell us we should do and get to zero emissions within 10 short years is that they don't understand that our food system and our system of agriculture and deforestation, the way we treat the land, are a major part of this. That I make the argument in Grassroots Rising, which is a roadmap for how we can get to carbon neutrality and beyond in just 10 years. Look, we're going to eliminate about 50% of our current emissions in 10 years because renewable energy is growing very rapidly, and energy conservation is more and more popular.
Yeah, so I think that people should drive around and kind of look, because I think if you go down to the southwest corner of the state, so many windmills, you know, maybe people don't realize that they're there yet, or solar is just cheaper and cheaper and growing and growing.
Yes, I think a case can definitely be made that one of the reasons we're going to reduce emissions by 50% is because that it's going to be cheaper to own an electric car. It's cheaper to have well-insulated buildings. And the investors are pulling out of fossil fuel investments right now pretty rapidly, not just because it's the right thing to do in terms of stabilizing the climate, because they can make more money from alternative energy than they can from coal or petroleum technologies. But what people don't understand is that we can suck down or draw down the remaining emissions that we'll still have in 10 years if we will just change our farming practices and our land use practices to organic and regenerative practices. In other words, the carbon that we used to have in the soil and the trees and the grasslands, a lot of that's now up in the atmosphere and the oceans. And if we're going to reverse global warming and not just slow it down, we're going to have to get that carbon back to where it once was and where it'll do a bunch of good. And this is not rocket science. This is what farmers and ranchers traditionally did. We preserved wetlands. You know, we didn't chop down every tree in sight. We didn't, you know, cage up billions of animals in confinement that should have been out eating grass and grazing. We didn't use all these chemicals, pesticides, and synthetic fertilizers that actually destroy the soil's ability to suck down that CO2 from the atmosphere through photosynthesis and put a large amount of it back into the soil. So we easily can reach zero net emissions by 2030, even though a lot of us in 10 years are still not going to be driving electric cars yet, even though they'll be cheaper to operate. A lot of us are not going to be living in zero emission apartment buildings and houses yet, but we can reach the global goal of zero emissions by 2030 if we'll combine what's called regenerative food farming and land use with alternative energy. And that's what the Green New Deal that's being discussed so much.
See, that's a thing that I've been a bit confused about, and I really want to get your perspective on this, because the Green New Deal to me is just so many things. So explain to me how food production, farm production in the Green New Deal, how you see that making sense.
Well, if you look more closely at a plan for the Green New Deal, such as the one put out there by Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, for example, you'll see that part of what they're talking about is not just reducing emissions, but sucking down the remaining emissions. In Sanders' plan, for example, there's, you know, $840 billion over 10 years to help farmers and ranchers make this transition.
And so what are we talking about? We're talking about it would be a grass-fed cattle would be, you know, walking around under windmills. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I was just in Iowa for the caucuses, and one of the things I noticed in Iowa is you can drive across the whole state and you don't see any animals anymore. I mean, it wasn't like this before. The other thing that you notice, whether you're talking about Iowa or southern Minnesota, is that all the rivers look pretty darn dirty. And in the summertime, you wouldn't think about swimming in these lakes or rivers. The way things used to look 150 years ago in this part of the world was grassland primarily. There were still a lot of trees out there. The rivers ran clean. And the animals, the herbivores, who are meant to eat grass, were outside eating grass. Now, in the winter, of course, you're using the hay that grew in the summer months. But on most days, animals can still be out there. I know I drove through an area of Iowa where I get my organic milk in the co-op here in Minneapolis, and the cows were outside. They were eating rolls of hay that were rolled out there. And so we've got to stop producing corn and soybeans on the scale we're producing them in the way that we're producing them. I mean, most corn and soybeans don't even go into human food. They go into ethanol, or they go into the food in these factory farms for the animals that should be eating grass. So we're going to have to convert back to the kind of traditional organic farming and ranching systems that we had, 50, 60 years ago, and we'll end up with food that's healthier, animals that are more humanely treated. We'll end up with rural communities that are populated again by people and that have schools and businesses, and we will also be reversing climate change. So
this is what I want, because that's also where we're going to get our bumblebees and our birds back. I mean, there's just and clean water. The amount of nitrate pollution in rural America right now is terrifying.
Yes, and if you have a regenerated landscape where you have trees out there in the environment, not just plowed prairie, you end up with cleaner water. Healthy soil filters the water. It also, when it rains, if what you have is an industrial farming landscape, it's like a tabletop. The rain hits the tabletop and it flows off. I mean, they actually use drain tiles to speed this water off the fields in an industrial, agriculture setting. If it's fertile soil, alive with microorganisms, earthworms and stuff, what happens is when the rain falls, a considerable amount of it infiltrates into the soil. And it's like a cistern below the soil.
Oh, Ronnie, I am so sorry. We're going to have to wrap this up. So I think that everybody needs to read your book. So Grassroots Rising, I have been, I've been covering this forever, and I really have not quite understood how we're going to get from where we are to where we need to be. But Grassroots Rising, you lay out a persuasive case, and I thank you for that. That's Ronnie Cummins, Grassroots Rising. We will be back here next week on Off the Menu.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.